Okay, this is my last day. We'll be here I'll be here, but I won't be speaking tomorrow because it'll be preparation at this time. So, what I was planning, I didn't get through all my subjects, but I was trying to get the subject I think, you could use and do something with. And so today, clap, give yourselves a hand for making it through all those amendments yesterday and all that math. I knew I was going to lose a lot of them when that started. But you need to know that stuff, and it's pretty simple. There's somebody's good at math, just division. So, anyways, today I had I want to get through weed management and hopefully pest and disease management, and I also want to try to do irrigation. That's kind of important, but I think probably these two are probably more important. So hopefully I can get through these two, a pest and disease and weed. And then the other one I really wanted to get to that I won't have time to get to, it's important too, it's planning. I found a lot of people just fail because they don't put things in the ground at the right time. It's not that hard. Once you get the logic down of how plants work and what plants belong in warm category and what plants belong in the cool season categories. And then, I showed you the layout in the beds. Well, I don't know if I went over it. I forget what I said sometimes, but, part of that bed system was you designate some beds cool season beds and you just grow cool season plants in there, and you designate some beds warm season plants and you just do your summer plants in there. And so that's part of the bed system. You don't want to put warm and cool plants together because, you want to take all those plants out at the same time or roughly the same time and do something different with it, put a cover crop in or like that. And then so you want to have, when you segregate in your plants, you want to have warm beds and cool season beds, and then you want to have, the warm plants, you can do different things, but you want to try to get them all in the same family and or all with the same growing habits, meaning they all kind of want to be in there at the same time and sort of check out at the same time. Brassicas are one of the biggest families. You got mustard greens, you got turnip greens, you got cabbage, you got broccoli. And they pretty much all have the same growing habit. They're all cool season usually. So, they work good together in the same bed, but you don't want to have a brassica bed here and then another little brassica here and another little brassica and another bed here, because when you rotate, you don't want to rotate in, or you want to have at least 2 years separation between the time you had brassicas in this bed and by the time you get brassicas in it again. You see what I'm saying? And that way it helps you break the pest and disease cycle. So rotation and having those standardized beds is the way you break some disease cycles and break some pest cycles. Okay, so that's why, kind of going back to layout, that's why that's good for pest and disease management. But things like beans, they're all in the same family, but a lot of the beans have different growing habits. Sugar snap peas, sort of like the early summer, late spring. Southern peas, where I come from, they like it in the late summer when it's really burning hot. So, those are, even though they're the same family, they're not, don't have similar growing habits. So they're not really good together. And you could match, you would want to keep, and beans, it doesn't really matter about keeping beans separate because beans are a building crop. So I always put beans in front of my tomatoes. So I always, because that's my prize crop, tomatoes. And I always like to build my soil with beans, and then I rotate out of beans, and then I'll rotate the tomatoes into them. And so I always, you just have little systems like that with your rotation. And that helps you become a better farmer. That gives you a 1% or 2% advantage and gives you a 1% or 2% being a better farmer or better gardener. So those are the things, and we'll get into that a little bit. Seems like I had something to say. Oh, 6:15 before the 7 o'clock program tonight. It's 6:15. I'm going to do tools out here out of the bed of my truck. So anybody interested in seeing some of the tools I brought, they're pretty. I'm going to go over a few of the weeding tools here, but I got some more tools in there, and they'll help you out. You need to get some special tools, like any hobby or any serious pursuit. You got to tool up a little bit, okay? And so 6:15 out in my truck, and it'll be like 30 minutes, 40 minutes max, and then we'll be done before the program starts. and hopefully get supper in before then, okay? Let's see, what else was I going to do? Another thing I thought about last night that I had heard at a meeting, and it was true too. If you ever get on an airplane and you fly over the fields like in the fall or in the late spring or sometime like that, when you might get a light dusting of snow, and you go over an airplane, and you'll notice like some fields just have no snow on them. You see all these checkerboards of agricultural fields, and you'll notice there'll be big squares with no snow on them, and then other squares have this white dusting of snow on them, and you're like, why is that? The farmer didn't go out there and snow blow his whole field, why is that? I remember seeing that, and I remember always thinking. Then I was at one of my conferences, I think it was an Acres conference, and a guy explained that. He goes, well, some farmers have a lot of biological life going on in their soil. They're a little bit more tuned into this than some other farmers, and they either get the manure on there and it has a lot of biological life and it's warmer and it'll melt the snow. And that's why. And next time you're in an airplane, you're flying over some snow country and it's not too, not too deep of snow. Just check that out. I think you'll see it. Now you'll know why. Okay, let's go get started with this. This is weed management. I found this on an SDA church website. Say which one, but I'll read it real quick. The Sabbath and we've all heard this. I mean, this is sort of standard. The Sabbath and the sacrament of marriage are the two divine institutions. Thanks. Are the two divine institutions that God gave to human beings in a sinless world. They were consecrated in Eden before man fell into sin. They represented the highest expressions of our love to God and to other human beings, as detailed in the Ten Commandments. Our adversary Satan and his whole confederacy of evil are making concerted efforts, and I underline that word, to obliterate both these precious gifts of God. Their assault against marriage are succeeding in alarming degree, and this is obvious today in widespread degeneration of marriage and family relationships, and of course, the assault against the Sabbath goes without saying, but I like that word a bit. Satan is making concerted efforts confederacy are making concerted efforts to obliterate these two, what they call them, divine institutions. Fundamental belief number 23, the Sabbath and marriage are, again, this is just a reiteration of what we just saw on the website, are two of God's original gifts to the human family. They were intended to provide the joys of rest. Oh, that's what it was. Forgot to plug that in. My bad. They were intended to find the joys of rest. The word there, I should underline the word rest. The joys of rest. The Sabbath was to do the joys of rest. That means the other days of the week. Yeah. And rest and belonging, regardless of time, place, and culture. The establishment of these two institutions culminating in God's creation of this earth. The establishment of these two institutions, and that's, we know, the marriage and the Sabbath, we all know. They were the finale, the best of his exceeding good gifts he gave humanity at creation. And provide the joys of rest. Okay, that was before sin, so we were working before sin, right? And remember, Satan and his confederates are trying to obliterate these two things. But maybe Satan's won already. Maybe he's got, let's see. So, what is the third Eden institution? We got the marriage and we got Sabbath, but one has already been obliterated. And that's garden. That's right in there with the other two. Just go and read it and look at it, okay? And remember, the Sabbath was for rest. Rest from what? Work. And what was the work? Gardening. All right, let's go on. Genesis 2:8, and the Lord God planted a garden eastward in Eden, and there he put man whom he had formed. This was a gift. It was just as much a gift as any of the other two things. Okay, now does it start to make a little bit more important? I mean, I'm hoping to build some importance of this thing to you, I mean, I know the Sabbath is a great gift, and I know marriage is a great gift. But this is right in there with them, okay? Amen. And the Lord God took man and put him into the Garden of Eden to dress it and to keep it. And that was a gift, okay? So it's all in there prior to sin along with the other two. Ellen White on agriculture. There's some books there. I think you bought everybody's bought the Jerry Travers's books in there, the ABCs of Education. That was on agriculture. I saw they were gone. But there's another Ellen White compilation there called Country Living, which is some lot of good Ellen White quotes on agriculture in there. Okay, and some of the ones I've got for my presentation, I pulled from there. And the other one they didn't have, they couldn't get, is a Rural Economy. So White from Teach. You ever seen that book, Rural Economy? You get it. I just think Teach didn't have any at the moment, and they were trying to reprint them. But if you're interested, call Teach, and it has even more than Country Living. It's full of agricultural quotes and other things too, but a lot of agricultural quotes. Everybody know what Teach Services is, right? That publishing house, Adventist Publishing? Okay. Here's one of my favorite Sister White. I won't do much of Sister White quotes, but here's one of my favorite ones. And when I go back over here, what I pull out of there is Ellen White indicated it was not supposed to be a ministry or a mission field. It was supposed to be an occupation. Okay, that means it provided a living. Everyone was to be involved in it somehow, you know, whether you did it or whether you supported it. And that goes back to my thing of, if you're not going to do it, at least support the local organic farmer who is doing it, even if he's not Adventist. I mean, that's your step in the door with your community. And yes, it's two or three, it's not that much more if you do join a CSA, but it might be two or three times more, you know, because, like I said, there's no small farmers I know that are, you know, rolling in the dough, okay, even though they're charging two or three times more than Kroger or Publix or whatever your grocery store is here. So, you know, that's how you get involved. And, you know, you can get involved with that farmer. And if you get involved in a CSA or that farmer's market, get to know that farmer and ask him if there's any way, that you can help him, maybe even administratively. Maybe you don't want to go out there, you know, into the fields, but if you could help them just administratively or help the farmer's market administratively, okay, that's getting involved in local organic farming. Okay, all that works. And also, other big thing that I pull out of her writings is she said, always says science is to be involved in this, and it's supposed to be done intelligently. And it's, you know, we're not just sort of approach it haphazardly. We're supposed to approach it just as much science as you hear on, you know, heart disease and the brain and all that. That's the kind of science we need to pull into farming. And we've got a lot of academics in the Adventist world out here. I mean, Gordon was a geologist, and I know he's a biologist by trade. I mean, these guys could bring so much light into the farming, you know, they folk train their thoughts in that direction. My favorite Ellen White quote on this is, agriculture should be advanced by scientific knowledge. There it is. Farming has been pronounced Now, see, I've liked this one because this is the same exact things you hear today is the same exact things she was hearing back then. Okay? It hasn't changed. The complaints and the moaning and the groaning has not changed over small farming. Farming has been pronounced unprofitable. People say that the soil does not pay for the labor expended upon it. We hear that today. And they bemoan the hard fate of those who till the soil, but should persons of proper ability, we need training in this at our institutions, proper ability take hold of this line of employment, not mission, not ministry, employment, and make a study of the soil and learn how to plant and cultivate and to gather the harvest, and more encouraging results might be seen. Many say, we have tried agriculture and know what it is and know what its results are. And yet these are the very ones who need to know how to cultivate the soil and bring science into the work. She's saying that there's this sort of people who think they know how to farm, and that she says they don't. They haven't studied it enough. They need to go back to it. And their plowshares would cut deeper, broader furrows, and they need to learn that in tilling the soil, they need not become common or crass in their natures. We have this, I mean, when's the last time you saw a TV program with an intellectual farmer on it? I mean, we got shows with intellectual lawyers, and everybody wants to be a lawyer. We got shows with intellectual doctors, and everybody wants to be a doctor. But we got no shows out there with intellectual farmers. I mean, they're just looked at as these dumb hillbillies that, you know, don't know any better, or they're these rich fat cats with, you know, big combines that nobody associates with. I got another slide here that most of the USDA farm subsidy checks are mailed to addresses in Manhattan, not the Midwest. We won't get into all that, but Let them learn to put the seed in its season. Again, timing, which or planning, which we're not going to go over. And to give attention to vegetation and to follow the plan that God has devised. And that's why I'm totally down on chemical agriculture. Is because that's not the plan God devised. Just like taking drugs and all these things we have in our hospitals, we say is not the plan God devised. You know, the eight laws of health are the plan that God devised when our health, for our health. When you're trying to grow a plant, there's a way God has devised, and that's the way we need to grow a plant. Just like we take care of our bodies, we need to take care of plants the same way. And the plants that give us the food we eat, and it affects the quality of the food we eat. We don't have a health message if we don't have a farming message. Maybe it wasn't that way prior to 1945 when they didn't have all the chemicals. But after 1945, you know, our health message is not going to help very many people if we don't have a farming message to back it up. Is that okay? I didn't. All right, and here, occupation. The goal is to make it an occupation, not to make it a feudalistic thing at an institution where, you know, everything for the institution and you're sort of just out there working as a surfer, the institution. You want to make this thing, you want to show young people that you can actually make a living. If you work hard and you work smart, you can actually make a living and you can be independent and not so dependent on all the things in, other things in society. All these people you see in this picture, I've met them all and I know them, some of them pretty good. Elliot Coleman wrote some of those books that are so popular. Now he's up in Maine. He's the guy who said you can make $80,000 gross on an acre, even selling in season. It's local farmers markets, using local farmers markets and CSAs. And I believe him. This is Alex and Bonnie. I think their name is Bonnie Hitt. They're a husband and wife team. They've been doing it for 30 years. They've been making a living small farming for 30 years. He handles the vegetables and she handles the flowers. And you make more money on flowers than you can on vegetables.
Wow.
That's a fact. It's at farmers markets. So always, if you're getting into, I don't know if anybody's in here is trying to be a market farmer, but if you're getting into it, don't ignore flowers as a cash crop, okay? And they also bring bees and good beneficial insects, so they have that plus too. This is Mark Kane out in Arkansas. He grows vegetables, but his big thing, he'll tell you, he makes half his fields in vegetables, half his fields in flowers, and three quarters of income is flowers, and only a quarter of his income is in vegetables. And he can make bouquets on the fly. That's the good thing. This is the DeVries family out in Pasadena, California, that have turned their land into, not only does it feed 80% of their food, but they make $40,000 gross a year on their fifth of an acre plot in a sprawling suburb environment. Okay, they do it. They do it too. And this is my mentor, Daniel, and here he is at Gaia Gardens, that townhome community, and he makes his living farming. So it is an occupation. Small farming is coming back. It can be done. Church sponsored farming. That's the thing I always wanted to get to is have the church sponsor. You got churches with land. You got farmers, like me, and hopefully there'll be more who want to do the work. Why not marry the two? And what's in it for the church? Good land stewardship, fresh, nutritious food, community building, relationship building, membership building. We could go into all these, and I could prove them to you. Membership satisfaction. People proud of church people are proud of a garden if they have it. Good public relations. And then there's always end-time preparedness. What's not in it for the church, the church can't get into it because there's money in it. The money has to go to the guy doing the work or the free food. So don't even go there. All right, let's get into weed management. Builds character and reveals character. This was that picture I showed before, and now I've married up with Genesis 4:7. If you do as well, shall not you be accepted? If you do as not well, sin lies at the door, and unto thee shall be his desire, and you shall rule over him. I always kind of equate this with weeds because they're always there, ready to take over. Okay, you're going to have to battle them. Every year they never go away. They just get a little less, but they never really completely go away, and they're always ready to creep back in and take over. So if you farm intelligently, it could consume you if you don't do it intelligently, okay? And this is what I hope to cover today. Now, we should look at weeds. They do have a beneficial thing. And one of the women here, I forget where she is, she told me, don't they tell you what's in your soil? Weeds. And she was on the right track. Weeds are nature's soil builders. Actually, weeds are able to exist where poor soils are. okay? Especially the noxious weeds, the ones that are really rooted in and, you know, really prickly or whatever, you know, they've got, they're just, you know, hard to get rid of, and they're bad when they're there. They're thorns and thistles. Well, these are nature's soils building. If you leave them there long enough and let nature do her things over hundreds and hundreds of years, they would actually build the soil, build an old soil, an old, you know, useless soil, and make it into something pretty productive and good. You know, you'd start getting bigger plants there and more complicated plants there, and those weeds would move on to some other bare soil. And so they're not that bad. They're just bad because when you're trying to grow a cash crop, they get in your way. But really, they're there. I mean, like I told you, something with a taproot, a weed with a big taproot, they're pulling up calcium from down deep, and it's dying and putting that calcium on the surface. So that's a way of building, you know, a dandelion is a way of building calcium on the surface rather than having the calcium all the way down there where no other plant can access it. Variety indicates the elemental, the variety of the weed indicates the elemental imbalance, decay problems in your soil, like your soils are not breaking down things right. Some weeds like methane gas. You know, when you bury some organic matter deep because you till too deep. I had a farm and they had loads of this, and we're going to get to it. It had loads of a weed, and I looked it up, and the thing that weed likes is methane gas that comes off of things that are rotting. Fermenting. Things that are fermenting under there because there's no oxygen. They've developed a way where they like that kind of gas, that formaldehyde gas and methanes and stuff like that. So that weed is telling you need to quit plowing your organic matter in so deep. And then when you quit doing that, that weed will go away because it doesn't have the thing it likes. Given time, weeds would fix these problems, preparing the soil for higher plant forms. Number four, weeds survive where other plants cannot. Remember, they're opportunistic. Learn their unique, you know, figure out why that weed survives there, and you're going to learn something about your soil. As soils become more fertile, weeds that do grow become trap crops for harmful insects. So, like I told you, I had that buckwheat growing. It was a weed. I didn't want it there. And it was the insects were eating the buckwheat and not eating my pole beans. So that's how that functions. I cultivated another good weed for that is amaranth. Amaranth attracts a lot of bugs that eat plants. They like the leaves of the amaranth. So you can use that as a trap crop. Cultivated small weed top. When I say cultivate, everybody know what I mean when I say cultivated? Means I just cut it. I just use one of my tools to just slice the top of the weed off. I don't reach down and pull it out by the roots. I'm just slicing it, right? I'm cultivating it. I'm tickling the soil or I'm lightly scratching the soil. That's what cultivate means. Just lightly scratching the soil or slicing just under that. And so when I do that to a weed maybe that's this big, the top of that weed falls over and becomes green manure for the soil. It's actually doing me a favor now. And the decaying root that I'm not going to bend down and pick up, I'd be there all day if I did that to every weed. Actually, the decaying root becomes organic matter for the soil organisms to eat. It's going to decay and rot and leave a hole there where air can go down and water can penetrate and earthworms can come up through it. So it's actually doing me a favor when I cultivate it. And it's improving my soil structure because that's good organic matter that my microbes can eat. Here's how weeds kind of tell you what's going on in your soil. And these are just general. It gets more specific with specific weeds. But you got two basic types of weeds. You got broadleaf weeds and you got grass type weeds. Okay? If you got a broadleaf weed, it's usually an indication. That one up there is beggar weed. It's usually an indication you got low potassium and you got low phosphorus and you got high potassium. Broadleaf weeds. If you got grass type weeds, it's usually an indication you got low calcium and high magnesium. And if you got weeds with tap roots, means you got low calcium. So there you learn something. It gets deeper than that, but that's some sort of a broad. At least you get you get a taste of what I'm talking about. When you get to the time of trouble, and maybe you don't have a, you can't send it to a soil lab. And we were talking about this today. When you're sick, you go get lab. Your doctor orders lab results so they can find out what's wrong with you. And those are important, right? Well, it's the same thing with the soil. You need to get your soil tested, or you just don't know. You're just guessing. It's worth the money to spend $50, $60, $70 on a soil test so you at least can now do something with intelligence. Okay, just like you would if your body was sick and you got a lab report. Now, in order to know what the weeds are telling you, you first got to identify the weed. And what this is called, taxonomy. It's proper identification. And, of course, the Latin language is used to do that now. And here you got all the different orders, the kingdom, the subkingdom, blah, 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 blah. All you get down here to the genus, species, and then there's something below the species called the variant. So this is a problem I had. This is a real case scenario. I saw this. This is, well, I got it up there, so I'm not going to, I can't test you. But that's called henbit. Anybody ever saw that in West Virginia? Henbit. Hens supposedly love it. That's what they call it. That's the common name. And I call it henbit in Georgia, and you might call it something here in West Virginia, and that's the problem. You know, when you're using the common name, you never know if you're everybody's on the same page talking about the same weed when you use the common name. You got to get it down to the Latin genus species name, and then you can look it up. Anyways, I saw this weed, henbit, and then, I don't know, a couple months later, the henbit was gone, and I saw this, and I'm going, at first I thought it was the same weed. I thought, man, you know, this weed is up and flowering again. We had a lot of it. And then I looked at it close, and I realized that, no, and I started taking pictures of the weed the two times I saw it again the next year, and I took a picture of that one, and they were not the same weed. And it's really good if you can identify things when they're blooming. Usually plants are classified by their flower. Okay, so you try to identify a weed when, you know, it's just little, and then it matures, and it looks like something totally different than when it was small. You know, you can get confused. But if you wait till it flowers and give somebody who's an expert in weeds, you know, at the university or at your extension office, if you give them the flower along with a picture of the leaf and the whole plant, they can usually identify it, and the flower picture really helps them out a lot. And this helped me out a lot. And I finally identified this. I had identified the henbit. That was no problem. But this I couldn't identify for about a year and a half. And I finally found it in a book, and it's called Purple Dead Nettle, and they're almost the same. You can see where down here, they're in the same family, and that's the mint family. That word means mint. And they're in their same genus, but their species are different. They have to get all the way down here before they diverge in the taxonomy chart, the flow chart. So, and then this one had a variant, insecum. So I guess there's different versions of purple dead nettle, or different variants of purple dead nettle, but not so much henbit. But anyways, that's how you identify the weed. And if you want to attack the weed, it's good to find out, is it an annual? Is it a perennial? Is it a warm season weed? Is it a cool season weed? How do the weeds propagate? Do they run little runners under the ground and just spring up everywhere with runners? Or do they propagate by seed? You know, figure that out. And once you have identified the weed, you can learn all this stuff. But don't just go into the internet with just the common name. Find the proper genus species name. Propagation, seed or rhizobium, and then the life cycle. Life cycle meaning, you know, what does it look like when it's really young? What does it look like when it's immature? What does it look like when it flowers? And on and on and on. This is a great book. I think I have it on my book list over there. Weeds and Why They Grow by Jay McCarman, I think it is. Anyway, excellent book. And inside the book, look at this. It has a little part in the beginning, like 10 pages you read. That's an excellent read there. And basically what I'm telling you today. And then when you get into the heart of it, see, there's my dead nettle. I finally identified it because I identified this right here. I used the scientific name. It's dead nettle. And what is that telling me? My calcium is low, which is usually all weeds. You know, once you get your calcium up, you alleviate a lot of weeds, okay? My calcium was low. My phosphorus, the pentoxide was low, or just phosphorus, we'll call it. And again, my potassium was high. And then, if you go to the next page, I don't have the next page. But anyways, there's another page over on the other side of that book. It carries on telling you about what that weed is telling you in your soil. Okay, it's got more and more information on the other side of the page. But anyways, there you go. There you go. That's how you read weeds. Okay? All right. Now, to manage weeds and get rid of them, you got to buy the right tools. And all these tools you can find in Johnny's. And that's where I get a lot of my tools. You can't go into the Home Depot or Lowe's or Ace because most every tool there is made in China and it's really cheap. And they don't even have these hoses. You might find this one. I think this one you can find there. What did the guy call it? An oscillating hoe? You know, the one that wiggles a little bit? I got it right here. Anyway, but this one you can find. Johnny's, it's a trapezoid hoe. I got the, if you want to go on the YouTube, you can see Elliot Coleman showing you how to use that. It's called a collinear hoe. It's basically a razor blade on a stick. This is another version. It's a little fatter and a little shorter, or a little smaller width, but a little fatter. It's called a trapezoid hoe. I like that one. This one, you know, this is about 7 inches long here. This one's only about 5 inches long, so it's a little more forgiving. This is a same thing, a razor blade on a stick, but a hand hoe version. You know, like when you're getting around real small stuff like radishes and carrots and stuff like that. And then here is a wheel hoe, which I got one up here. This is a wheel hoe, and that's the same thing as this, the stirrup hoe, but you're able to go over much greater distances without getting tired with a wheel hoe. So if you got a big, you know, you could probably do, I don't know, 50 feet with something like that, a 50-foot bed. But if you got over a 50-foot bed, you might want to spend the money and get a wheel hoe, and you can cover a lot of ground. And while we're here, let me just switch gears here. And I wanted to pass this around for all you guys that didn't make the little class on how to put this together. We put this together. This is a drip tape. You can pass this around. And this is supposed to go on this end, but they sent me the wrong connection, which always happens. And that's supposed to go in here. That's your filter, your reducer, and then your drip lines coming across on your bed. Okay? You can pass that around. Let me do it. And then I'll show you some of these tools that are right here in the picture in real life. This is a trapezoid hoe. I don't have a collinear hoe because each of these tools is about $50. They're made in Switzerland. They're quality products. And you can change this blade out. And the blade is cheaper than the whole thing. So, you know, they're not tools to be meant to throw away. They're tools to be meant to hand down to your grandkids, okay? And they're $50. They're expensive. You can go to, you know, you can't buy them at Hope Depot and Lowe's, but you could maybe try to find something that was similar and spend $18, $20, but it's going to break on you, okay? So I like buying quality stuff, and hopefully Americans will start making this and we can quit sending our money to Switzerland to get them. But, you know, Americans have gone to big farming, but they're still doing little farming over in Europe. And so that's why they have these good tools over there. And they still like craftsmanship, you know. Anyways, the way you use... First, let's just go in the order. Now, here are the stirrup hose, and these are from Johnny's. They're quality. I didn't get the cheap one from the Home Depot or Ace. And you can replace all these parts. You can see they have screws that you can undo. Anyways, I got two sizes here, but there are about five sizes of these, okay? These are the stirrup hose or the oscillating hose, and they're designed to wiggle so they can cut both ways. And all you do is, these are for between rows. Okay, not between plants, just between rows. And to go down your curb. You know what the curb is? The curb is that little edge between the walkway and the first row, okay? Let me see if I got a picture of this. Yeah, okay, this kind of demonstrates it better. He's using a wheel hoe, but you could use, he's going between rows, right? And you could use this for the same thing if you didn't want to afford, you don't want to buy the wheel hoe. You could use this for the same thing, and all you're doing, can everybody see me? Here's the ground, and all you're doing is slicing just under the ground. You're not trying to go deep with this, and you want the soil, you're not trying to move soil. That would be a lot of work. All you're trying to do is slice into the ground and slice that weed and have the soil just move over the top of that blade. Okay? And that cultivates that weed. Now, you've got... None of these tools will work if you let the weeds get this big.
Oh, yeah.
Okay? They will not work. So don't complain to me like, oh, I bought your tools and they don't work, Scott. I'm going to say, when did you try to weed them? Oh, when they were this big. Well, they don't work when they're this big. You have to get out there when they're, I mean, like a quarter inch tall, when they're just starting to bud through the ground. That's when you weed. That's when... Smart people weed, people that are approaching this with intellectual pursuit in mind, okay? They don't forget about their garden and sit there and come out there and say, oh, I better do something when the weeds are this high, okay? You might as well just mow it down and start over, okay? And that's what I'm getting at here. I mean, look at the guy on the left with the wheel hoe. I mean, most of us would look at that ground that he hasn't even weeded yet and say, what's he weeding for? There's no weeds there. But that's when you need to weed. When they're that small, you can barely even see them, okay? And when you do it that way and you've planted your spacing right, you maybe have to do that two or three times, maybe two times, maybe two times probably definitely, but maybe three times. And then the plants are big enough to own that space and the canopy will own that space and the weeds won't come after that. Yeah. So you don't only have to weed two, maybe three times while the plants are small. But when they get big, you don't have to anymore. That doesn't work for garlic. You kind of still got to weed garlic because it doesn't have big leaves. But anyway, most things with a broad leaf. And then if you wait too long, like this guy with his corn, that look how he's bent over, you know, he's hacking away. This is meant to just use standing straight up, just going through your soil like this. And you just go fast down between your rows. And then when you're finished going between your rows, you come over here and get the trapezoid hoe or a collinear hoe. It's a little wider and narrower. And then you come in and get between your plants with this little razor blade on a stick. You know, so the part you missed with this, you got in between the rows. Here you're getting in between each individual plant. And when you use this, look how it's made. You're just, again, you're just having the soil. You're just trying to slice the weed just below the surface. Okay? And it's a young weed. So it's like, I don't know of a good explanation, analogy, but remember, you know, people go to jail because they shake babies and the babies die because they just shook the baby. That's all they did. They just shook the baby. Well, the babies can't handle that. You know, they're too fragile when they're that young, right? But if you did the same, if you shook a teenager, well, they're not going to die. They can handle that, right? Think of the weed. I mean, the weed is an infant. If you kill the weed when it's this big, you slice it, it's not coming back. Most weeds, there are some weeds that propagate by rhizobiums, but most weeds propagate by seeds. And if you kill it, you slice it when it's this big, it's not coming back. But if you try to slice it when it's this big, it'll come back. It's got too much energy. It's got too much strength in it. It'll come right back. So you got to get out there when they're small, okay? I'm trying to make my point here. But here, I always use these two tools and sometimes my wheel hoe in combination. You know, I go down the rows first with this, come back and go down the plants with this. And the other thing I need to make certain you know is when you go use this tool between plants, you always want to, you're standing straight up, you're not bent over like this. It's made to use standing straight up with your thumbs up, and you're just sliding around the plant, okay? And you're going down and maybe come back and do the other side this way, or maybe you can catch two rows at the same time and then go around to the other side of the bed and catch the other two rows. And the thing is, you're always weeding, you're always slicing towards the plant. And that's a little counterintuitive because like most people, and I'm like most people, when you do that, you're always afraid you're going to slice right into your plant that you're trying to, you know, protect. But don't just get good at it. Just keep doing it. Because if you do it the other way and start stripping dirt away from your plant, your plants are going to suffer. You're going to move a little dirt. The idea is not try to, you know, you're trying not to move too much dirt. You're going to move a little dirt. And the little dirt you do move, you want to move it towards the plant, not strip it away from the plant. But that's because all those roots have little hair roots, and you don't want to expose them. Okay, you want to move dirt towards your plant, not away from it. So it's a little counterintuitive. When I first started, it took me all day to go down it because I was just so afraid, you know. But my mentor Daniel, you know, he goes, "Wow, it really takes you a long time to weed, doesn't it?" I wasn't much help to him, I don't think. I didn't want to cut any of your plants, you know. And he goes, "Well, pick up the pace a little bit, and if you waste a few plants, don't worry about it. You know, just part of learning, you know, kind of thing." Okay. And I got faster and faster. Now, you know, you just can fly, and you don't wait. I still waste a few plants every now and then. I get my mind starts going off somewhere, you know. But it's very therapeutic, and I can do this standing straight up. I can do this all day long. If I had a big American hack hoe like that one guy, you know, you do this for about 30 minutes, and you're toast. You want to go to lay down for the rest of the day. Okay. But with this, you could just sit out there and, you know, all day long. It's no sweat, you know. Get you a big sun hat, keep your sun away from you, make sure your arms are covered. And then the wheel hoe, I mean, anybody can come up here and look at the wheel hoe, okay? The other thing with these tools, and here's the hand hoe here for radishes and carrots. And the other thing with those hoes, in your off season, maybe once during the growing season, you're going to have to get you at least two files. One is a rough file, and the other one is a smooth finishing file, okay? And you're going to have to keep these tools sharp. It's just like in the kitchen with a dull knife. It's hard to do kitchen work with a dull knife. It's hard to do weeding with these dull razor blades on the stick. They got to be sharp. And you got to sharpen them like at least twice a year. Okay. What's next? Here's my garden. they just started reiterating. That was a big scale thing there. This is a small scale. You can see it's. I have a half moon hoe here. It's pretty much like a trapezoid hoe. That's before I bought my trapezoid. But I'm doing the curb here. I got a little too close to the curb in my planting. Now I like to keep like 6 inches off the curb. But I think these are radishes or mustard greens or something like that. Anyways, I use this is a good one to do. When you're doing the curb with this trapezoid hoe, I like to come in and sweep up and sort of rebuild that edge. You know, kind of that little mound that I had made before. I kind of like, instead of, and that's what I'm doing there. And you kind of, it's better, I used to stand on the opposite side and kind of go like this, but you don't get a good angle that way because you're not slicing. Now I stand on the same side and kind of sweep up and weed. And that way I'm bringing dirt to my plant and I'm sort of reforming that bed a little bit, because after a while the sort of dirt on that curb gets spread out. And then you can see I got my stirrup hoe in between the rows. So I knew I had a picture in here that sort of demonstrated what I was saying. See, the stirrup hoe is going in between the rows, and this is made to go in between plants or do, you know, redo the curb, something like that. Okay, over here, that's the typical American hack hoe, I call it, where you're bent over like this, and you just destroy all the tap roots, and it really takes a toll on your plant. And you can see most of these things, the guy waited too long before he weeded, and most of these things are going to come right back on him, okay, because he waited too long. The other thing about this, I think I got this in one of the bullet points, but the other thing about this destroys some of your surface roots. This right here, this actually helps roots grow. When you cultivate the soil, you disturb your surface roots a little bit, but because you're not going very far into the surface, you don't disturb too many of them. And the ones you do disturb, it kind of like pruning them, and they branch out so there's more roots. So it actually helps the plant to cultivate it lightly, just under the surface. Okay, so that's a way you help the plant. Okay, timing. Look, this is what I'm talking about. Even this is a little too late. Everybody's done sprouts, right?
Yeah.
Okay, you know how when you're looking at the sprouts and you're looking at them every day, a little white thread comes out?
Yeah.
That's basically when you want to weed. They call it the white thread stage. And you can't see it from the surface. You kind of got to use your hand and sort of brush it back. And then you see it. But here is you don't want to get much past this. See these little weeds coming out? And that's when I was a little late. It was past the white thread stage and they were actually starting to put forward leaves. So I'm a little late here, but I'm not too bad. That's still what I would consider an infant weed and perfectly killable with a stirrup hoe here. But here's a friend of mine who said, oh, I better go weed the corn. And I said, wait, let me take a picture of that. That's a good comparison, because that's what you not to do. I mean, look, this corn is, I mean, they're going to be in there hours. I'm going to be done with this, my little garden path. That takes me 5 minutes. Maybe 10 minutes. That's exaggerating. Maybe 10 minutes to do that one little L-shaped bed up there, okay? It's like 25 feet. Takes me 10 minutes. And I'm out of there. That makes farming enjoyable, okay? If you wait till it gets like this or like that corn patch over there, nobody likes to garden like that. They're like, I'm not doing this again. So, you know, you got to do the smart things and you got to do them at the right time to keep yourself in the game, okay? Bullet points. I know they're boring, but okay, we'll have to go through these. Outside the beds. Okay, you got your growing beds, and you got your walkways, which are outside the bed, and then you got your peripheral. Remember, the 4-foot wide beds and the 2-foot walkway, a 2-foot wide mobile walkway layout. Remember that layout I gave to you. That layout helps you control weeds. You're mowing the walkways and you're mowing the periphery. Remember, don't let that mowable part get away from you, because you want to mow the walkways, and then you want to, if it's a rectangle with the walkways in the middle and the beds in the middle, you want to mow around the peripheral of your whole garden at least 10 feet. 20 feet would be better, okay? And that's good too when you're doing your layout. You want to have some open ground, because if you're right up next to the woods, you're going to get rodents and squirrels and everything else, because they can hide in the woods too quick. I mean, it's too accessible for them. If you give them some open mowed ground to traverse, they're not going to want to travel that open. They're going to think twice to travel that open mowed ground. Okay. Plus, if you let your peripheral and your walkways get weedy, then one weed gone to seed is 7 years of weeds. Okay. The more you keep that stuff around the beds mowed, the less weeds you're going to have to deal with in your beds, okay? Because you're not going to have those seeds going everywhere, okay? That makes sense, right? Mow, do not weed the walkways. And then when you're mowing the walkways, you got to get a mower that doesn't have a side discharge. And even if it has a rear discharge and you don't bag it, it can't blow out too much stuff. It's got to be a mulching mower that kind of drops it right there. If not, I bag mine sometimes, the rear bagger, and then I re-dump it on the walkway. Okay. Mow before the weed seeds out. Okay, we already know that. Inside the beds, now inside the 4-foot growing area, initially, okay, this is a great way to control weeds, and it's part of the irrigation thing too. But when you put your transplants out or you direct seed some stuff directly in the ground, water the transplant only. Get you one of those wands with a shower head and go boosh, boot with a trigger sprayer, go boosh, 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 boosh. You know, every transplant, if it's a direct seeded thing, you got seeds all down the line, water all the way down the line. Come back and do this is part of irrigation. Come back and do it 3 times, not just once. You always want to water in threes. But you want to water after it's soaked in. Go back a second time, and after that soak in, go back a third time. So, but doing it that way and not just sitting there spraying the whole bed, you know, with water, because what you don't water, you won't get a weed so quick. Okay? Weeds are going to come up where you water. So just be very localized with your watering. Okay, we already did number 2. Weed when the weed sprouts barely visible. We already talked about that. Wheel stirrup hoe between rows. We already talked about that. 5, we already talked about. 6. Okay, number 6. Weed just prior to a couple of hot, dry days. That's important. Even what I just told you, if it rains right after you weed, the chances of those little infants rerooting is a lot greater. So if you want to weed, you know, you want to have a hot day when you're weeding, and then maybe a hot day the next day, and they're not coming back. They're going to dry up and die in the hot sun. Okay, you kind of want to play the weather and not weed right before it rains. That makes sense, right?
Yes.
Okay. You guys are quiet out there. I don't know. You're going to have an amen.
Amen.
All right. Number 7, plant the same day the bed is prepped. And that's another important one. A lot of people do. They go out there, they got some time, and they go out there and they prep the bed and get it ready to plant. Good, good, good. That's good. But then they wait like a week before they actually plant. Bad, bad, bad. Because now you've given that, 7 days for weeds to start growing, and now they're going to be way ahead of whatever you're planting. Okay? So you always want to plant, you always want to prepare the bed the same day you're going to plant, or at least no later than the next day. Okay? I know sometimes that's an impossibility. You only have so much time. But at least don't let it go longer than a day. Okay?
But that was like 2 weeks, you said.
Now what? I don't want to confuse you. What?
Yeah,
that's a rough till. That's good. I'm glad you asked that. That's a rough till. You rough till and let it set 2 weeks so it'll digest. But then you're going to have to come back and that, because you got stuff sticking out. You know, it's all rough. All your stuff is tilled in. It's lumpy. It's bumpy. And it's But then you come back 2, 3, 4 weeks later and what you do is a light finish till. And that's when you want to plant right after. Good. I'm glad you cleared that. Is everybody clear on that? But good, I'm glad you brought that up. But when you're doing a finished till and preparing that bed to plant, you want to plant that day or the next day to get ahead of the weeds. Number 1, don't weed cultivate. Okay, that's what real farmers do. Real farmers don't weed, they cultivate. Big guys, big farmers, when they got their big tractors and they're doing acres and acres and acres, they don't go out there and pull weeds, do they? Nobody could ever do that. And they can't afford to hire a bunch of anybody to go out and do it, to do it for them. So what they do is cultivate. That's what you do. You just do the same thing the big guys do. You just shrink it down to your little garden plot, okay? You cultivate. And cultivate means getting rid of the weeds. Every farmer knows that. Some of the gardeners don't know that, what it means, but farmers know that. If you wait until the garden starts to look weedy, you've waited too long. Like I said, you want to get out there when you can barely see any weeds, okay? We already went over that. Shallower, okay. The shallower, a lot of people have brought this up, and this is a good point. If you till, a lot of people like to run their tiller down their rows and cultivate down the rows and really stir it up. Well, you're bringing up weed seeds when you do that. You're going to have more of a weed problem. You know, you're going to get weeds, but you're going to create a more of a weed problem. When you shallow cultivate, like I'm talking about, just under the surface with this, you don't bring all those weed seeds up. Most of the weed seeds that are going to You disturb the things right on the surface, and most of those are already germinating. So you're getting rid of those, and you're not creating anything new, okay? By bringing it deep from deep up, okay? What else? Number four, use transplants rather than direct seed whenever possible. That's another thing I need to cover, because a lot of people want to just go out there and throw seeds in the ground. Now, big farmers do this too. They have, you know, the guys sitting in the back of their farm and they're putting transplants in the ground. But when you're smaller, you can really do this. Okay, this is where the small gardener has a little bit of an advantage. You can go out there and grow your own transplants or buy them. But I like to grow mine, and I got the stuff, and I can tell you how to grow your own transplants, because you get so much more, you know, variety when you grow your own seeds and your own transplants. But you always want to grow a transplant. And Elliot Coleman wrote in his book, he says, or something like this, I'm paraphrasing, he said something like, you know, if you just throw a couple seeds in the ground, I think I might have said this earlier on in the week, but he says if you just throw a couple of seeds in the ground, that's a gamble. You know, trying to get a little infant cash crop up from the little infant stage when everything in the world wants to eat it, you know, because it's a little infant and it's juicy and it's young and it's tender, and then get it past all that danger into a plant is a real big risk. When you can grow it in a protected environment, like a, you know, a heated greenhouse, you know, or something like that, or a covered hoop house, in a tray, and you can water it, you know, and be on top of the watering, and you can grow you a nice, you know, transplant. You know, transplants, you want to transplant them when you got two, at least one set, hopefully two sets of true leaves. I can tell you what true leaf means later, but, you know, get them up so tall, and then transplant out. They're going to have a much better, half of the things are going to eat them. You've already passed by them, okay? They're already this big, and most of the bugs that are going to eat them now, you know, you've wiped out about 80% of your bug problem planting a transplant. And you're not doing transplants so you can get ahead of the maturity date. You really don't gain a lot on maturity dates, okay? Don't think you're going to gain, you know, it's a 60-day to fruit. Don't think you're, well, I put this in 4 weeks ago in my greenhouse so I can wipe out 28 days of that 60-day maturity date. No, you can maybe wipe out 7 days. Okay, you might get a shorter, like from the time you transplant it till you get a fruit, but you're not going to gain 28 days on maturity date. Okay, it's basically to get ahead of the weeds and get ahead of the bugs that you use transplants. There's some things you can't use transplants on, like beans, and you know, some people say okra doesn't do very well. I grow okra as transplants, but I try to grow everything I can as transplants, unless it's something that's just. Usually, you don't grow things as transplants if they grow really fast, like radishes. Or they got a big taproot like carrots, you know, you probably direct seed those. Or beans, they just don't like their roots messed around with. Beans got a little shallow root system, they don't like their roots messed around, so you got to plant beans in the ground. But everything else, do everything as a transplant if you can. Number five, strategic watering, we already covered that. If the battle's lost, at least mow the weeds before they go to seed. If something comes up in your life and you've done all this work and then you walk away for whatever reason, emergencies or whatever, at least go out there and mow it before it goes to seed. And then when you start back on it any time, you know, you're not going to have all those weed seeds to contend with. Cover crop, undersow the beds and cover crops. Cover crop, undersow in beds and walkways and fallow fields. You know, try to grow a cover crop and at least get good things that are easy to take down, like some of your grasses, and then legumes in there that give you nitrogen. And row spacing. The spacing is really important on weed control because, like I say, you want to stagger it and then you want to space it just right. I mean, you're going to have to do experience with this. I mean, that comes with experience. But you want to get a big, full-size plant, but you also want to make sure the canopies touch. And that controls weeds, okay? And sometimes the packages are right and sometimes they're wrong. And, you know, don't really go by the package or what you see on tables. You can use them as guides, but you're always going to have to tweak them. Okay, so spacing is part of weed control. Okay, here's a great picture. I love this. You know, people get onto me because they think I'm OCD on straight beds and lining the beds and edging them and all this stuff and using certain tools to make sure the rows are straight. But I'm telling you, when you do it that way, when you get a little OCD on making straight beds and straight rows, and not have undulating things going here together like this. They're all the same equidistance. There's some tools I'm going to show you at 6:15 that can help you with that. It's a lot easier weed because when you're going through these sort of repetitive motions, you're not always continually having to adjust. Like you're going along and, uh-oh, I can't get through there. It's too tight. I've got to pick up, bring it back down, and then I've got to get another tool and get in the little area where it's too tight, and you're wasting time. It's going to be out there a lot longer. You want to keep everything straight and equally spaced, and that way when you're doing the weeding, I mean, it's the same thing. It's repetitive motion, and you're never having to sit there and make little adjustments, and you don't get as tired, and you can just fly through it, okay, because it's the same motion. Does that make sense? So be a little OCD when you're laying out your and you're planning. Get a measuring tape out there and plant them 6 inches apart and make it straight. And there's ways to do that fast, too. Transplants, direct seed, okay. So rows spacing strictly, okay, we already did that. Spacing the row is tight. Yeah, okay, that's an important one to get across. You know, here's my littlest between row hoe. It's 3 1/4 inches. I found through experience that I'm happy when I plant the smallest. I don't care what the package says or what. Oh, sorry, I need water. What? What the package says or what the book says. This is my smallest between row smallest between row spacing, and really this is about 6 inches. Okay, if I get it tighter than that, I start ripping into stuff. So about 6 inches is as tight as I'm going to plant anything. You know, even if the book says I can go tighter, because this is my limiting factor. This hoe. Does that make sense? Okay, that's important to get across. Have some. Thank you. Have some water somewhere. Appreciate that. Thanks, Rick. That's good. Thanks. That'll get me through. All right. Row spacing, where the stirrup hose and collinear hose come in various widths. We already covered that. Yeah, there's about 5 sizes of these. So you can, I got 2. You can go, and that's another, that's a little wider. They make them 1 foot wide. If you want to get 1 a foot wide. I'm trying to get all of them, but yeah, it's a slow thing. This is another great advantage. This is called, a lot of people call this clean cultivation or shallow cultivation. And you're doing it early when the weeds are small. And the other great thing is 2 things. Well, actually, there's 3. But 2 things here. See right here? See all that branching on the root? I forget what plant that is. Some guy did this in a book. It's called Roots Demystified. Anyway, he's got all these pictures. And you see this? This is, you clean cultivate out here, and it sends these things down. It sends these ends down into the ground. Okay, that's what I was talking about, the pruning. When you clean cultivate the surface, it actually stimulates root growth. And that's healthy for your plants. When you shallow, clean cultivate, it sends the roots down and they can tap into more stuff instead of just being all out there in the surface, you know, which is good. They need some surface roots. I'm not saying the surface roots are bad, but all of them out there, you know, when you clean cultivate, it prunes some of them, not all of them, and it sends them down, okay? And that's healthy for your plants. You'll actually see your plants look healthier when you clean cultivate. I mean, it's like getting a rain or something. They actually pop, you know? And then the other thing is, after a heavy rain, how many people have had experienced that? After a heavy rain, or you just gone out there and you've seen it crusting. Everybody seen that? Yeah, you see this crusting? That's bad. Because remember, there's microbes under there. You're trying to get the microbes, that's how your nitrogen gets in there. That's how your air gets in there. So you want that soil to be able to breathe. I mean, in the daytime, your soil is exhaling. And in the nighttime, it inhales and it exhales and it inhales, and in order to do that, that you can't have that surface crust. Now you know why that surface crust develops, don't you? Somebody wanted to guess? Hazard? Huh? Nope. I sort of gave it away when I first started talking about this picture. It's the heavy rain. You'll always get this after a heavy rain, especially in clay soils like I have. Maybe not so much in sand, but in clay soils, you'll always get this after a heavy rain, and that's because, you know, these big raindrops come down and they smash into the soil. And if you don't have good biological life, even right there on the soil, kind of aggregating that soil up, it'll smash that soil and it'll turn it into fine powder, right? And then it, you know, percolates down or goes away or dries up. And you got this fine powder now settling in on top of your aggregated stuff, but it's settling in 10 minutes. It's settling in. And it creates a crust in the sun. And that's how you create that dry crust. It's also an indication, if you have a lot of this, it's also an indication your calcium to magnesium ratio is too tight. Okay, you need to monitor your calcium magnesium and get that 7-to-1 ratio, available calcium, available magnesium. So that's how clean cultivation will break that up. If you see that, just clean cultivate it. You can actually see weeds like that tightness. You got weeds coming up there. Okay? They like that tight sort of lack of oxygen. So you want to break that up, and so you can get the oxygen flowing again. And weeds don't like that. They like bad conditions, not good conditions. The other advantage is, again, plants live off energy. And when you stir the soil, even the rain, some of that rain pop you see is the rain stirring the soil. When you stir the soil, all these molecules start flying around because new compounds are next to other new compounds. When the soil just sits there for a while, everything that's going to switch partners electronically, or molecularly switch partners, it kind of stabilizes out and it gets sort of stabilized. And then you have no life. You have no energy. But then when you stir it with your weeding, your shallow cultivation, new things end up next to each other. And they go, oh, I want to jump over here. And the other ion goes, oh, I want to jump over here. And so you get that energy flowing back into your soil again when you stir the soil like that. Okay? Again, this is proper timing is essential. There it is. There's the white thread stage. And you had to actually brush the soil back to see that weed starting to grow. And this is when you want to weed. Here it's showing you that, this is the crop just coming out of the ground. They direct seeded this. You need to weed right when you know where the... That's why you don't really want to weed until you know where your cash crop is. So when you just start to see your cash crop, get in there and weed because you know you're not going to hit your cash crop, okay? This is the bad thing of a skimpy stand. You don't want to sit there and say, well, I only want to buy this many seeds, so I'll plant, three seeds per foot or, two seeds per foot, and that'll save me on thinning. Get in there, you'll just have to thin. You want a thick stand. Because if you don't get thick stands, this next picture shows you why. I don't know what was being grown here, but right here, I like this. This is the bed with three seeds per foot, and this is a twin row, six seeds per foot. So he increased his seeds by two, and he got a much thicker stand and much less weeds. So don't cheap out on buying, get you a thick stand and you can thin later. Okay? Then you got another part of weed control we all know is mulches. You got natural mulches, straw. Everybody knows the difference between straw and hay, right? Okay, everybody knows. It's straw doesn't have as much nutrients, but it has a lot less weeds. Okay, hay has more nutrients, but it has a lot more weeds. So unless you can get the third cutting of hay, which has a lot less weeds than the first cutting, unless you know you're getting a third cutting of hay, I would always use straw. Unless you can make sure you're getting the third cutting of hay. I would always use straw. The pros are, weed prevention, of course. If you got to do it thick enough. You can't skimp out. You got to do it at least, 4 inches thick. And what I like to do with this stuff, ever done this stuff and you see how it comes off in slabs? Yeah, I just tile my beds with it. I don't really sit there and shake it all up. I just try to, sometimes the slabs come off a little too thick and I'll just mush it out. But I try not to leave that interconnectedness in the hay bale. I try to leave that, at least at some level, all together. And I'll mush out the other stuff. And I'll just basically tile my bed and not shake. You save your lungs and everything else, okay? The cons are, you get some soil-borne diseases reduced. But it costs money. It's like right now where I live, it's $450 for one of these bales. Installation and labor. Have the potential to get, because it's organic matter, to increase your potassium. And you got to get timed right. A lot of people go out there and they want to do everything in a wonder. They want to get it all done and then just walk away. So they mulch way too early. They put their tomatoes out, and that's okay. And then they want to mulch it at the same time. But it's too cold. The soil's too cold. And then when you mulch it when the soil's too cold, you lock in the coldness of the soil, and your potato and your tomatoes or whatever you're trying to grow never get warm soil. You've insulated cool soil. So you want to make sure you put some mulches on after the soil temperatures have warmed up. So I plant my tomatoes, and then it's maybe 3 weeks before I ever even consider putting mulch on them. And I always put the mulch on a hot day so I can lock in the heat rather than lock in coolness, right? So that's important. Then you got your plastic mulches. We can look at this slide later, but it's got its own pros and its own cons. The thing with plastic mulches is, you never get free rain. You're going to have to drip irrigate if you plastic mulch. But it's got some pros, and some people think those pros outweigh the cons. I kind of like free rain and all that. I don't use a lot of plastic mulches. But I've heard a lot of people sing their praises, and I don't doubt they're, you know, there's something to them, and I wouldn't be adverse to using them. Other message, you know, everybody heard of solarizing? Sometimes you can prepare a bed by solarizing, do stretch black or clear plastic down, and you got to leave it for like 6 weeks in the hot summer to kind of kill any weeds there, and it kills them about 6 inches deep, and then you can plant. Then you can de-sod. That works sometimes. Cornmeal is supposed to be a natural herbicide that doesn't hurt too many things except the weeds. And then wood chips, but that guy on Back to Eden makes it look a lot easier than it is, okay? But, and I would use wood chips for certain things like perennials or blueberries, but I wouldn't use them if I'm growing annuals. You know, I'm too active with the soil when I'm growing annuals. I don't want to have to work around a bunch of wood chips. You know, I want to work with the soil. I don't want just wood chips sitting out there. I think my method is a lot better than his on when it comes to annuals. But I would do his method on perennials. Elliot Coleman says, cultivation is the shallow stirring of the soil surface in order to cut off the small weeds and prevent the appearance of new ones. Weeding takes place after weeds are already been established. That's weeding. When you let them get too big and you have to pull them out, get on your hands and knees and pull them out of the roots, cultivating is what real farmers do before they get big. And that's the end of weeds. I got 5 minutes to run through pest and disease. But, okay, real quick, we'll try to get through it. Insects, pest, and disease, you know, they're, like I said, this is going back to the bricks and the refractometer. If you can get your bricks up, you won't have weeds. What insects are telling you is, I put on here, don't kill the messengers. They're telling you your plants are not fit for human beings or any mammal to eat. You know, insects take out bad plants. They're giving you weak food. They're giving you nutritionally deficient food. And then God put them on this earth to eat those kind of plants. Okay? They're really not that, you know, they're not as bad as people make them out to be. They take out the trash. But people kill them, they kill the insects with poisons and they eat the trash. Anyway. This is your best defense against any kind of insect. A good soil is your best defense. High bricks is your best defense. Balancing the biology, balancing the chemistry, balancing the physics, the energy. I put that up there to show you, look at how shiny that is. I mean, you got all this biological life in this compost. You got all this bacterial slime shining. I mean, this is good, aggregated, rich compost, okay? That's your best defense. Good soil is your best defense. Again, because the plants have an immune system, just like people. And if you feed them drugs with chemicals, they're not going to be very healthy, and insects are going to want to eat them. But if you feed them the good stuff, like you feed, to feed people the good stuff, then they're going to be healthy, and they're going to be able to. They have natural defenses against bugs. In general, this is Gary Zimmer. Some of my books are I've read. I think I got them on the book list. In general, crop pest, you know, just so you don't think I'm crazy, here's some other guys backing this up. In general, crop pest disease play a role of guardians, not want destroyers. There you go. That is that they are there to selectively attack, destroy, and eat plants that are weak and unfit, plants that are sick and would not produce good food for animals or humans. Okay, many experiments have proved that plants given too much nitrogen fertilizer, and that's most of our commercially agriculture crops. Nitrogen becomes the answer for everything because all they're interested in commercial growing is yield, because yield is money and the bottom line, okay? That's all they're interested in, and nitrogen will give you big plants and yield, okay? I mean, I don't want to get too far into that, but anyways, let's see what he says. Although they may grow fast and look greener and are actually physiologically unbalanced and more susceptible to pests and disease and attack than plants grown with balanced fertility. But the same guys that are selling you all the nitrogen fertilizer are the same guys, the same chemical companies that are selling you the pesticides. So they don't care. They make money both ways. They make money when they sell you the nitrogen. You think you're growing a really big plant. Then you say, oh, I got bugs. And they say, oh, I got a pesticide. Come buy that too. So, you know, come on. How plants resist pests and disease without toxic chemicals. Number one, genetic factors. Inherited traits to grow rapid and strong. You know, you want a plant that's growing fast. A fast-growing plant's a healthy plant and a happy plant, and it resists diseases, okay? That's a genetic factor. And then you got your induced resistance. External help, whether natural or from man. You know, cold winters. That helps a plant out because it breaks some of the bug cycles, right? You know, people say, well, it was a warm winter, we're going to have a lot of bugs this year. That's true. So, but you can also have the farmer's fertility management program. If you're farming for healthy plants, you've induced an outside influence that makes that plant resist insects. Okay? Plant mechanisms resistance. An example would be the glossy sheen on a leaf, or the thickness of a leaf, or the hairs on a leaf. The hairs are actually there for a number of reasons. One of them is to make it difficult for bugs to crawl over the plant, right? Repellent chemicals. Plants can actually, when they're attacked and they start getting eaten, and they can, a healthy plant can make what they call secondary metabolites, meaning they can actually, if they got all the minerals they need, they can actually make chemicals that'll poison the insect. But they got to have their base needs covered first. They got to have enough nutrients to cover their base stuff, their primary metabolites, okay, like growing and that sort of thing. But then they can produce these toxins, these secondary metabolites, if they're healthy. And they can actually ward off attacks with their own odors and their own chemicals. Thomas Jefferson wrote this great quote. This is before they had chemical companies and all these to put on plants. I mean, how did these guys live? How did they make it back then? How was Thomas Jefferson a farmer without, you know, DDT or, you know, what's the popular 2,4-D and all this stuff and stuff? I mean, how did these guys grow anything? We should be extinct by now. When the earth is rich, and he was writing to his daughter, who was having problems with her plants, or bugs in her plants. He says, when the earth is rich and bids defiance to droughts, yields in abundance and best quality. When the earth is rich, it bids defiance to droughts, yields in abundance and best quality. I suspect that the insects which you have harassed you have been encouraged by the feebleness of your plants and have produced by the lean state of your soil. That was written in 1798 by Thomas Jefferson. And you can see this kind of thinking, I'm telling you right now, isn't something new. It was known long, long ago by successful farmers like Jefferson. USDA, the government, the ones that okays all these chemicals, it actually came forward and said, well-fed plants are usually less susceptible to soil-borne organisms than poorly nourished plants. Good fertility may so enhance the resistance of the host plant, the parasite cannot successfully attack the roots. Healthy plants resist insects. And then Elliot Coleman said, about modern farming, he said Galileo realized, he came up into problems with the earth is round. He would have to mold anew, this is Galileo, the brains of men in order to establish another understanding. The change I'm proposing from a preoccupation with pest destruction, like I gotta go kill that bug, to a focus on plant construction requires a similar remolding. But it is a change that will allow us to eliminate pesticides and simultaneously grow more nutritious crops. Get away from the chemicals. That's what he's saying. And right now, use of chemicals is so entrenched in big mainline agriculture, right? It's so entrenched. Farmers don't, they've been so bamboozled by the chemical companies, they don't see that there's any other way. And And he's saying it would be like Galileo having to explain to people that the earth is round. You're running up against people like me and more educated people than me that know this is the right way to go. No, they're running into this wall just about. They might as well be trying to tell people the earth is round like Galileo was running into. They just don't see it. And then this is, I'm over time, right, Daniel?
No.
You're the moderator?
Couple
more minutes. This is Dan Scow. He was Kerry Reams' friend and kind of his disciple. He's getting on a bit now, but he said, if you got a bug problem and you just don't want to rip out your plants or mow them down, he said, but basically I find that fish and seaweed combined together with food-grade phosphoric acid, is quite effective in keeping insects out of the field, especially if the Brix is below 12 and your Brix in the leaf sap, right? You can keep insects, and this will temporarily raise the Brix in the leaf, and bugs won't go after a high Brix leaf. And a mixture will substitute the sugars when the latter are not high enough for the plant for protection. You want high Brix, but let's say you don't have high Brix. Let's say you're just starting out. Well, you mix these three things together, and I think I got the formula on the next slide, and you can bring the Brix up, and hopefully the plants will move to another plant that's lower in Brix. When you deliver a higher level dissolved solids into the plant, high Brix, the result will be a healthier plant. Finally, in the field, the delivery of more dissolved solids into the plant confers immunity to bacterial, fungal, and insect attack. Many times the insect problem can be answered more effectively with a combination of the three things again, fish, seaweed, and food-grade phosphoric acid, then spraying with pesticides. He's just temporarily raising the brakes. And here's the formula. You can cover 2,000 square feet with a foliar and 1 gallon of distilled water. Remember, we like distilled water when we're doing foliars. And you can write that down every 10 to 14 days. Move on. Okay, ready? Ready? We can come back to it. I'll skip the first part. This is Malcolm Beck. I think I got a book on him in the book list. He's a really neat guy. I've seen him speak. The last paragraph is what I want to read. This first paragraph is a homebrew for fire ants, okay? But this last paragraph is, all wasps were beneficial and, like most other wild creatures in nature, only become aggressive if they feel the nest or their young are threatened. Then the sting may be only severe as the threat that they perceive. Treat them as friends and neighbors and they will return to favor. Remember, wasps are one of your primo insect, friendly insects that help get bugs out of your garden. Okay, so anytime you see a wasp, try to encourage wasps into your garden, okay? By growing little flat flowers, you know, that they love the nectar on and stuff like that. Let's see. Oh, one more. This is, again, just like the weeds, you need to identify. You can see all these are in the same, even in the same suborder. Okay? And basically that word, But anyway. You can count. See, right here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It means 5. And all these bugs are in the same family, and they all have this sort of segmented backs of 5. But they all look very similar when you're out there, right? So you take a picture of them, and the reason I put this down is because they all look very similar, but this is a good bug. It's a predator bug. It actually kills other bugs. You wouldn't want to kill that bug. You wouldn't want to squash it. You wouldn't want to get rid of it. This is a stink bug. It really can go either way. It's an omnivore. Okay? It can be a pest or it can be a beneficial. If you see that it's being a beneficial, don't kill it. Assassin bug is a predator bug. It's a good bug. And, of course, the squash bug is a herbivore. It's a bad bug. So you can go to bugguide.net and you can start identifying bugs on your own. Okay? That's a good site. This is what I use. A cabbage worm or any soft-bodied worm, I use Dipel, which is just Bacillus thuringiensis. It breaks down in the sun, it washes off in the rain, but it doesn't harm any of your other good bugs. It just harms the caterpillar, the soft-bodied worm that's eating your plant, okay? And it's organic. Mammals can eat it and not be affected. You can eat it the same day that you can put it on and eat the harvest. It's OMRI approved. It's organically approved. When you get hard shell bugs, usually here's some ways that doesn't work, okay? There has to be a soft-bodied bug. But this, you know, you have to pick them off and put them in water. This is a Colorado potato beetle, and here's the egg, here's the larva stage, and here's the adult stage, and here they are dying in some soapy water that you just hand-pick off. Now, that takes some time, granted, but you can avoid some of these bugs by planting crops early. I know some people will grow real early spring potatoes, or they wait and will grow real late fall potatoes. Okay, and they try to not have potatoes in the middle of the summer when these bugs are bad. So you can kind of plant around them. BT can be used at the larva stage. So BT might work on this soft-bodied part. Okay. Also, I've seen people get out there with shop vacs with a couple of mothballs in the shop vac, and you can just suck them off the leaf because they get really heavy infestations. Insecticidal soap is OMRI approved, organically approved, and it gets rid of stuff like aphids. But also, you got your ladybugs working for you with aphids, so just encourage ladybugs. Or you can use this. This is pretty mild and doesn't really hurt many other things. This is something I had. This is my pest, Scott's 2011 Insect Pest of the Year. These are usually good. They're in your compost pile. They're called earwigs, but here they were doing a lot of damage to my tomatoes. Yeah. So, Yeah. So, but what do? You pick off the damaged ones. You just don't leave them there, and you go throw them as far away as you can and break their cycle. Okay. That's about.
We're gonna have to close and people get down there.
Okay. All right. That's it. Sorry.